Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, EU tariffs threaten to hit South Africa's steel industry hard. Average salaries climb 3.4%, but not evenly across all sectors. Cape Town's property boom is squeezing out locals, and the retirement savings gap is widening and time is running out. It's Wednesday, the 15th of October. South Africa's already fragile steel sector has just been hit with a multi-billion rand blow. The European Union has imposed steep new tariffs on South African imports. That is a move that could cost billions in lost export revenue and also place thousands of jobs at risk right across the steel and downstream manufacturing industries. Make no mistake, this is a problem. Labour, business and government now face tough questions. One, how do you protect workers? Two, how do you keep industries alive? And also, how do you remain globally competitive when your biggest trading partner essentially slams the door? Well, I want to give you one perspective on this, and joining me is Marius Krookamp from Solidarity. I want to talk about what this means for workers and maybe what is being done, what can be done to soften the landing. So Marius, bluntly, and good evening to you. How many jobs are on the line if these EU tariffs take full effect over the next year?
Oh, good evening. If one looks at the full value chain perspective, because when one talks about the steel industry, it does not just affect the steel industry. If the exporters go down on a big scale, there are secondary industries which are affected as well. So the total impact could be as much as 600,000 jobs is being estimated.
Which is catastrophic.
Yes, it's a lot. It's obviously, it's tremendous. And one should do everything in your power to attempt to mitigate that.
Well, let's talk about mitigation then. How ready do you think unions are to negotiate real protections? Things like retrenchment terms, maybe redeployment plans, wage support, if this export shock bites. What's the strategy that you're starting to think about?
Well, obviously, unions are well prepared. And the reason I say this is because unions deal with this on a daily basis. A lot of work that we do are when businesses close, when industry are affected, and we try and work with employers to find alternatives. So in terms of our experience, I think we are well geared to do that. However, the state of the economy currently and the limited alternatives make it difficult for us to secure mitigating measures. So it's going to be very challenging. When the economy is doing well, it's much easier. But in this case, we've got a double whammy with internal challenges and also the external challenges. Solidarity in particular, we've got infrastructure that we have that we specifically can use in terms of these type of challenges. Our research leg is very strong. We have a backbone where we can try and secure jobs for people on an electronic platform. And we have a social leg where we can assist families and organizations in need.
What's your negotiation starting point, though? What can a trade union like yours put on the table immediately to I guess, government and to employers?
Well, it's important that one looks at the entire situation. You know, one's got to look at reality. Are there alternatives? Are we talking about a plant closure? Are we talking about an entire industry or a sector of industry that's going to close down? So obviously, first of all, very important, find the facts, and from there we work and see what alternatives there are. This specific issue one can call an international issue, so we got to do an outreach to the Europeans and talk to them about this, you know, mitigate, see what extensions can be done. It's our view that these measures are being implemented in a hurry, and the effects thereof is going to be felt by South Africans and developing nations. And maybe just hold with the rush. We've seen with the European Union specifically, they are harming their motor industry. Big manufacturers are in big trouble because of a rapid move towards electric vehicles, and the market is not picking up sales to sell those vehicles that they brought into the market. So you've got to be very careful and see how you do this. What we got to be careful of is are things like subsidies and so on. The market conditions should be there for a sustainable industry and a sustainable company.
Marius, government says it's going to explore trade diplomacy, whatever that means. From your standpoint, do you think Pretoria is moving fast enough, or I sense that we're probably way behind the curve on this one?
Well, our experience in terms of the American situation is that government is moving slowly. Now, trade diplomacy is extremely important, and it's important because we believe it's not limited. Government does not have the monopoly on it. So it's important that civil society, like unions and employers, reach out as well and engage with people on the other side to assist. And what I mean by assist is to assist to get to that deal, to get to that situation where there's a compromise. Obviously, it's impossible for a trade union to sign a trade deal with another country or a European Union, but there's a role to play. We can assist in getting there. And that role should be recognized by government, and they should allow us to contribute. Yes.
Is government allowing you to do that?
Well, we've seen difficulties with the American situation. We've done it anyway. But there was negative comment from specifically the government itself. And it does not help that situation. There should be cooperation, because actually we're striving for the same goal in the end. Nobody holds a monopoly, but we do hold a monopoly in securing workers' future. And that's what we have got to do and have to achieve.
Who would Solidarity be reaching out to in this particular instance?
Well, we've already engaged. Our engagements were not limited to the US. We engage with Europeans as well. And I think as CBAM gets closer, we will engage even further. In particular, I engage with European steel unions during the COP negotiations, and we were privy to sit in some of those caucuses, very important and very interesting, because even then the European industry was not ready for what was being agreed by the politicians and the leadership. It was fascinating to view that these guys were actually flabbergasted to what has just been agreed, that's been forced onto them, and a further extension of that process. That's why it's important to go engage with industry and politicians and so on.
But that's the problem. I mean, a union-to-union engagement between South Africa and the European Union isn't going to achieve as much as if you engage directly with the employers. And I'm sensing that's not happening.
Well, we do engage with employers. You've got to remember that CBAM is going to be implemented on companies, not a country. So if you've got an exporter, for example, in Vereniging, that makes a certain product that's exported to the European Union, they will in the end be measured according to those measures by the European Union, that side, and the company that they deal with. And there you can look at certain mitigation matters that can be addressed. So it's important to make sure that you are involved in those processes. But it will not be, in the end, a country-to-country process. It will be those exporting companies that will be involved.
Marius, I wonder if you're not wasting your time engaging with the EU and the United States for that matter. A key market has been closed here, particularly as far as the EU is concerned. Surely you should be pivoting more aggressively to new markets in Asia and the rest of the continent.
Oh, if one looks across the border, there's a massive Chinese steel factory that's been set up in Zimbabwe, which does not have environmental constraints, which does not have cost constraints, which does not have energy constraints. They will capture a lot of that market. We simply are not competitive enough. So there's an overselling of these opportunities that might be in Africa. In Asia, you look at, we'll start with the world steel situation. There's an overproduction of and supply of steel worldwide. And the most of that production comes out of Asia. So the potential to break into these markets and find a full alternative.
It's almost impossible.
It's almost impossible. Therefore, obviously, one's got to always search for those alternatives, but it's important to go back to where your current clientele are and your customers are and try and see what you can do there to mitigate this.
Marius, I need a quick answer in conclusion. Does your union back subsidies or bailouts to keep steel jobs afloat, even if it means taxpayers carry the burden?
Well, the problem is that these subsidies do not work in the long term. We've seen with Newcastle that there was bailouts paid and it didn't work. So a business environment and a policy environment that sustains business and industries are the most important thing that should be worked towards.
Marius Krookamp, thank you very much indeed from the Union Solidarity. I do appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, average monthly earnings in South Africa rising 3.4% quarter on quarter to around 29,290 Rand in Q2 this year, with year-on-year growth at 6.5%. Those are new numbers from Stats SA's quarterly employment statistics. But beneath the headline, the wage ladder is uneven, as you're about to hear. Only 43 of roughly 90 job categories tracking pay above the national average, with finance adjacent and utilities roles topping the list. Sectors like textiles and hospitality still at the bottom. I want to explore this in a little more detail. The Acting Deputy Director General at Stats SA is Solly Molai. Solly, a very warm welcome. So that 3.4% quarter-on-quarter lift in average monthly earnings, do you have an idea as to what specifically drove that?
Thank you so much, Jeremy. So maybe let me start explaining the concept around the average monthly earnings and the gross earnings. So the average monthly earnings, we're looking at the middle month of that reference quarter, and we're comparing it with the middle month reference quarter of the previous quarter. So in this case, yes, we have noticed that there's an increase, and then largely this increase is driven by your business sector, which normally they pay their bonuses in March. So our bonuses, in most of the case, we have been getting our bonuses in December, but for the big banks, it's always around March. So in quarter two, that's where we're starting to see a little bit of a drop. As much as there's a drop, the average itself is have increased slightly. And I just wanted to also to explain a little bit more in terms of the average earnings. If you look at it backwards, if you look at it in 2019, before we hit by COVID, we were sitting around 22,000. Which it was around February, and now we're sitting around 29. So over time, we've seen a slightly an increase of average monthly incomes. But then if you look at the employment itself also, it has slightly increased. We have actually recovered from the numbers that we had in 2019. So both indicators, they've seen a positive one, and then one will see in the next quarters the rate in which they're increasing is a small rate, because if you compare across the quarters, we are averaging between 2 and 1, depending on the quarter which we are referencing.
Let me look at it year on year rather than in real terms. After CPI, how much of the 6.5% earnings growth actually translates then into purchasing power gains for households?
Yeah, so that for the QES, you wouldn't necessarily see it in that manner, because we don't factor in this. But then if you take it into the household itself, and then you look at it from the income and expenditure survey, and then you look across different population group, you will see that the average household's income, especially for Black African, compared to the other population group, it's quite low, especially against the income expenditure. So if you look at the income vis-a-vis the expenditure, the difference between these two amounts, it's too small for Black Africans. Whereas for white, we're talking about 400,000 in terms of income, average income. The income is about 600,000 and the expenditure is about 400. So you got about 200,000 in terms of the difference between the two for whites. Whereas for the Black African, it's the lowest even compared to the colored, even the Indian and Asian.
Solly, of the 90 job categories that you rate and measure, only 43 pay above the national average. What does that mean for broader wage distribution then?
Basically, what it means, Jeremy, is that there's more work that needs to be done. And again, it depends on the sector. Other sectors are a little bit technical. That's why they are their salaries. And depending also on the employment, type of employment, in terms of contracts that they're getting into. Hence, these averages, one have to be careful in terms of how when you compare it by different industries. But overall, I think it says to us as South Africans that there's more that needs to be done in terms of the salaries. And again, we also need to take into account that the averages is also including your bonuses and also including your overtime. Let me put it that way, your overtime. So if you take that into account also, one have to be careful, because the other industries, you don't have this type of income that I'm referring to.
And do you do a measurement on how public sector and state-owned entity pay patterns compare to the private sector?
One thing that we've picked up, especially with the community services, which is where you'll find your your government, your provincial department. We've seen that over time, they actually, in terms of their bonuses and in terms of their salaries, they are within the requirement of the frameworks that we are utilizing in South Africa. What else in other sectors, that's when we're starting to see, especially sectors like your trade, your sectors where you find mostly of the employment contract are a little bit different from within the province, I mean, within the government, because government in most of the case, these are your permanent jobs. The only thing that we picked up now recently, and I think this is the consequences of what happened when you look at our economy and also looking at the budget that Treasury has to work with. We're seeing that provincial departments, that's where you're getting most of the contracts, like your EPWP. We saw a lot of decrease in terms of employment, about 53,000 as an overall community services. But for provincial departments, for EPWP, we're talking about 28,000 contracts that were not renewed. Nationally, when you're talking about teachers, which is a very important sector, you're talking about 16,000. Health and social workers, and this, Jeremy, it talks to the funding that the U.S. normally gives to this sector. We're also starting to see about 16,000 jobs. And just to add on the health and social work, this is where you find female, especially African black females, who are employed in this. And we have seen from the QLFS, which is the labor force survey, that the employment numbers, when you're looking at unemployment rate for black females, is higher than the averages. So one can anticipate that in the next subsequent quarters, we will see high numbers in terms of unemployment for black African women, considering that their sector, or the sector that they're mostly employed, which is your health and social worker, they are now starting to bleed in terms of the jobs.
And just a quick one in conclusion, time is against me. Are there notable provincial or metro sector differences?
For this project, for the QES, we don't go down to the provinces, because we are now talking to the businesses. So we don't break it down until the provinces. But one can, like I said, already tell you that in the community services, when you zoom into the provincial department, that's what we're seeing. I think what we're seeing from the QES, and you compare it with the QLFS, one can definitely see that in quarter two, in terms of the employment in South Africa, because remember, the other one is, if we may simplify it, the other one is the supply, the other one is the demand. So the supply is from the household side, where you're looking at how many people are looking for a job and how many people are looking.
Right.
Whereas the QES looking at now in the books of the employers, how many are they? We are seeing that in quarter to quarter, there's a bleed in terms of the number of jobs. And QLFS already told us that there's fewer of South Africans who are looking for a job. The books from employers, they're actually confirming that minus 80,000 jobs were lost when you compare to quarter to quarter. And only two industries, which is electricity and mining, had a positive.
All right, I'm going to leave it there. Solly Molai, thank you very much indeed. Acting Deputy Director General at StatsSA.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, Cape Town's property market has always been hot. Of that, there's no doubt. But it seems these days it's on fire. In just the first 5 months of this year, and listen to this, foreign buyers spending more than R1 billion snapping up homes in the mother city, driving record-breaking sales in suburbs like Clifton and Bishop's Court. But as luxury prices surge and millionaire migration accelerates, a growing number of locals are asking whether the city is pricing its own people out of the market. Someone who's been applying his mind to that is Grant Smee. He's a regular guest on our program, the Chief Executive Officer of the Only Realty Property Group. Grant, welcome. Let's start with that big number, R1 billion in foreign spend. It's impressive. At what point do you think this stops being good news for the economy and bad news for local buyers?
So I think we need to take the R1 billion and put it into perspective that at the average purchase price of foreigners of R2.7 million is actually only about 370 properties. So I think it's a really impressive number, but it really comes down to the fact that there's a small proportion of foreign buyers. Yes, they are buying the more expensive properties, but it's actually not from a quantity perspective really anything overly over the top.
But the potential is there, and that trend surely is likely to accelerate.
Absolutely. So I think we're going to see continued price increases in the Atlantic seaboard, which is a traditional stronghold of foreign buyers, and southern suburbs. And I think that is where we're going to see local buyers certainly price out of the market. unfortunately. But the reality of it is what it brings to the economy is the benefits outweigh the negatives in terms of that. But there are other areas and other pockets which remain affordable and continue remaining affordable for locals.
Let's look at some of those affordable suburbs in just a moment. But you also call this foreign investment splurge a vote of confidence. I buy that. But maybe it's also fueling a market that ordinary South Africans can no longer access. Have we not reached some sort of nexus point here?
So it's difficult, you know, with the performance of Cape Town, the beauty of Cape Town, the limited supply of stock in Cape Town, again, in particularly those areas we mentioned, Camps Bay, the Atlantic Seaboard, CBD, southern suburbs. I think we're going to continue seeing those increase in prices, and it's going to be very difficult to stop without regulation. And I'm really hesitant for there to be regulation around foreign buying. It's just the impact on the economy could be very, very negative. So I think, the positives certainly outweigh the negatives. And something that we need to just almost embrace from a Capetonian perspective, that foreign buyers will continue driving the market and bringing benefits to the economy here.
You also speak about opportunities in affordable suburbs, point taken, but at some point there's going to be a ripple effect. For how much longer can that last, do you think?
Yeah, certainly. I think, again, people that are coming into the property market, so that don't own, certainly are going to find it difficult, and there's accessibility for first-time buyers through financing of the banks. But if you already own a home in Cape Town, the benefits to you of these increased prices obviously come to you from a capital increase perspective and your ability then to continue buying and growing. So I think the growth it brings to the local economy and to locals who are homeowners is certainly beneficial. So it does, again, become difficult when you're talking first-time home buyers or people moving from out of the Western Cape into the Western Cape. That certainly does. But again, semigration has been a big driver, not just foreign buyers.
Grant, Cape Town's geography obviously has its limits in terms of supply. There is talk about measures like foreign buyer surcharge or even short-term letting restrictions. Do you think that would strangle things?
Absolutely. I mean, I think foreign buyer surcharge is a terrible idea. I think, you sort of stop a flow of investment into the city and into the country of foreign buyers and sort of put a bit of a negative perspective on home buying and investment into the country. And we've already got that around expropriation without compensation, sort of conversation that happens all the time. So I think we don't need the more negativity. In terms of Airbnb regulation and that space, I think there's definitely a requirement for Airbnb regulation. I think it's a bit of a Wild West at the moment from an Airbnb perspective. There certainly needs to be a regulation. The only cautionary line here is to not over-regulate that space and make sure that operators who are doing it well, who are doing it properly, can operate freely and profitably as possible.
The Airbnb example is interesting. It has become a powerful investment tool, a grant for many people. But is it really contributing to the broader property economy, or is it just pushing up rental prices and maybe even hollowing out communities?
Yeah, I think there's swings and balances here. I think certainly it's put definitely in certain pockets, pushed rentals to extraordinary levels. You know, again, CBD, Atlantic Seaboard, your long-term rental values have been pushed up to very, very high levels. We do see at times of the year, so certainly off-season, you get these much cheaper rentals, but then it's for these medium-term leases, 6 months or 8 months. So it has had a negative impact from a long-term rental perspective, but from a capital growth perspective and adding to the economy from in terms of tourism and accessibility for tourists to come to Cape Town, it's got that economic benefit. So I think, again, it's a double-edged sword, really.
And Grant, banks are introducing more interesting and maybe even creative financing options like group buying, for instance. But there's an argument against that, isn't there, that it's a symptom maybe of broken affordability rather than just a solution to a problem.
100%. So the group buying is an issue, is only around investment. So it's not for you to buy a home and live in, which I think the core problem and the core fundamental issue we're having is the ability for people to actually afford a home. So that's either in a long-term rental space or the ability to buy and live where they work and where their community is. So I think, from an investment perspective, the banks are coming to the party with buy-to-let products or those co-buying products, which is great from an investment perspective. But, where they are really stepping up for first-time buyers is offering products to first-time buyers that are buying a home, 100% bonds or 105% bonds to cover some costs. So they are coming there. But that really is, again, like you say, limited by the underlying affordability of the individual, which I think speaks to the broader economic problem in South Africa.
Just a quick one in conclusion. Obviously, this trajectory is going to continue. What kind of city do you think Cape Town's going to be in 5 or 10 years' time? Is it going to be a vibrant community or maybe just an enclave for the wealthy?
So I think, talking about pockets, I think it's very difficult to talk about City of Cape Town as one collective entity. Mm. I think you are going to have these enclave of, for the wealthy, again, Atlantic Seaboard, probably CBD waterfront, which I think probably almost already is. And then you're going to have these vibrant communities, and they're certainly being developed, or there's gentrification in the areas, which are becoming quite exciting. Brackenfell, Kells River, the northern suburbs is certainly a space to look at from an affordability perspective, future growth perspective, and really with affordable housing there. Pinelands as an area is there's development around that space, which is again community driven and affordability driven. So I think there are opportunities for people to buy into areas in Cape Town where they can join a community and really sort of live the lifestyle that they'd like to achieve in the Western Cape.
Grant Smee, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer from the Only Realty Property Group.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, for most South Africans, the dream of a comfortable retirement is colliding hard with reality and colliding very quickly these days. According to the 10X Investments Retirement Reality Report, only 6% of people are on track to retire securely. The rest are staring down a future where working beyond 65 is no longer a choice. It's become a necessity. Rising costs, undersaving, longer lifespans, forcing us all to rethink of what retirement looks like. Well, to discuss this, I'm in conversation now with certified financial planner, author and coach, Kim Potgieter. It's good to talk to you again. Why do you believe only a tiny fraction of South Africans are truly prepared for retirement?
Well, firstly, people aren't prepared for retirement because they always think it's not going to happen to them. It's one of those things that's so far away. It's not going to happen to me. I'm still so young. And then also things are just so expensive. You know, we have so many responsibilities, so many costs, so we haven't put the money aside. And then lastly, we haven't got a plan. And because we haven't got a plan, there's no strategy to get us to this place of retirement.
So your data, or the data, shows nearly 90% of under 60s expect to work after the age of 65. It also, Kim, says a lot about the changing nature of retirement in South Africa, doesn't it?
Well, and the fact that we're all living so much longer, it's a reality now. I mean, I have many clients coming up to 100 that I'm working with. It is a reality. We're going to be living so much longer. So that time that we used to maybe have 20 years that we needed to fund is now possibly 40 years, and none of us have enough money for that.
So we'll talk about retirement saving strategy in just a moment. But Kim, that concept or the idea of retiring completely, when I think back to my father, for instance, you know, at the age of 65, you know, he put a punctuation mark next to his career and that was it. Do you think that that is still realistic, or do you think the entire notion is now completely outdated?
I personally think it's outdated, not even from a financial point of view, but from having a contribution point of view. So I always say to people, let's rather put a comma. I don't think we need to work at the pace we've been working. We don't need to be saving, but maybe just starting to draw down on our money at a later stage and rather still earning, because at the end of the day, it gives us more purpose. It gives us more value that we're adding to the world.
So how should people realistically be saving now if they want to retire with a modicum of dignity?
So, I mean, they must have a strategy. You know, people always want me to give them the percentage that they should be saving or investing. But it doesn't work like that, Jeremy, because every person that comes in has got a different story. They've got different needs. They've got different responsibilities and people that they are also paying for. So there's a necessity to come clean with yourself about where am I, where do I want to go, and what are the steps I need to take to get where I've got to go. But you do need to come clean with yourself.
Often easier said than done, though.
It is, but you said, how do you have a retirement where you can do it with some kind of dignity? Nobody's coming to do it for you. And this is what I always say to people, stop putting your head in the sand. it is something that is important. It may not be urgent, but it is incredibly important that you're putting in intentionally the steps that you need to take to do this, because our country does not look after us if we are in retirement.
So when do you need to start having that take your head out of the sand conversation with yourself and those close to you?
So, Jeremy, I mean, ideally, we want to say, you know, we should be doing it in our 30s. It's so much less stress in our 30s, our 40s, our 50s. I mean, I got to sit with a couple this week who were both in their early 50s. And unfortunately, from providing for their families, they haven't got a whole lot of investments and savings. And I had to say to them, it's not too late. It's really not too late. We can do it now. So when the later you do it, is the harder you've got to work and is the harder you've got to be investing.
So what was the starting point then for that couple in their 50s?
The starting point is first look at about what it is that they want to be doing in their retirements. Remember, all different people want to do different things. We looked at what they actually had, and we realized that there's a big shortfall. And it was encouraging them both to think about their work differently, because the one thing that they could do now is either spend less, earn more. So what you're needing to do then is to up your time in your 50s, work a lot harder so that you've got this kind of, you can invest as well. And then it's your mindset to understand that you possibly are going to be working up until you're in your 70s. But if you get the right mindset around it, it is incredible how things change as opposed to, I have to do this.
Kim, I acknowledge the advice, but difficult these days in South Africa to spend less given the nature of our economy right now.
I agree with you. That's why I always say to people, what can we do? We need to work harder, find a way that we can improve our kind of relationship with money, where we don't have to have a whole lot of things to make us happy. And actually putting the money away and seeing it grow can also bring us an incredible amount of satisfaction. So for me, there's so many levels to it. And Jeremy, it's emotional, and we can do what we want and we can pretend it's not emotional. But when we have these discussions, there's a whole lot of emotions. There's a whole lot of beliefs that we've picked up and mindsets. And we become quite fixed when we get older in our mindset. And it's kind of opening this all up and re-challenging what this next chapter looks like.
Difficult, though, to balance emotional and financial planning for retirement, isn't it? How do you achieve that balance, do you think?
Well, for me, that's where you get a person, a certified financial planner, to work with you. Because when you're in your own world, I have to have a financial planner work with me. When I'm in my own world, I'm emotional. I've got a whole lot of triggers. But somebody else comes in with the numbers, but they understand you. So the combination of somebody who can have those discussions with you and the fact that you're doing them. And if you're in a marriage, in a partnership, you bring your partner in too, because this is where it all goes wrong. We often put the pressure all on one person and both people don't take the responsibility. And we are needing to share the responsibility. As you say, things are very expensive.
So just a final one then. In your consultations, what's the most common blind spot that people have when they imagine their retirement years?
Well, I firstly don't see that people don't see themselves as their greatest asset. So they see their money as their greatest asset. And I like to work with people that they understand their personalities, they understand their values, and they understand all the wisdom that they've got up to this point. How do they repackage it that they can actually earn some money from it? So for me, that's one. And then the second one that always comes into all of this is we don't see how long our lifespan is going to be. Things have changed, and we can't think like we used to when we were trying to fund just 20 years. We're now trying to fund a lot more.
As you said, possibly even 40 years. Kim Potgieter, thank you very much indeed. Always good advice. And that's our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.